On this Wednesday, May the 5th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your Wednesday headlines. In a ruling from its oversight board, former President Donald Trump will remain suspended from Facebook, at least for now. But the company does have 6 months to review the matter and make a final decision. When Congress returns next week, expect the focus to center on the House GOP. Congressman Steve Scalise, the second-ranking House Republican, publicly backing Representative Lee Stefanik to replace Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney as the chair of the House Republican Conference. And earlier today, in a statement, former President Trump saying that Liz Cheney has, quote, no business in a Republican leadership, endorsing Representative Stefanik as, quote, a far superior choice. The CDC is predicting what it is calling a sharp decline in COVID-19 cases by mid to late summer. It comes as the U.S. has now administered at least one shot to more than half of the adult population. And one of the nation's leading drugstores, CVS, announcing it will be offering walk-in appointments for its chains across the country nationwide. This story is shaping Washington Today ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with today's announcement by Facebook upholding the social network's ban of former President Trump, ending any immediate return by the 45th president to mainstream social media, while also renewing a debate about the company's influence over online speech. At today's White House briefing, reaction by Press Secretary Jen Psaki with this question from NBC News correspondent Kristen Welker.
Facebook has decided to keep former President Trump off of its platform for now. Senator Ted Cruz tweeted the following: for every liberal celebrating Trump's social media ban, if the big tech oligarchs can muzzle the former president, what's to stop them from silencing you? What do you make of that comment? Does he have a point?
Well, let me first say that this is an independent board's decision, and we're not going to have any comment on the future of the former president's social media platform. That's a decision that it sounds like the independent board punted back to Facebook to make in the next 6 months, as I know you all have reported. The president's view is that the major platforms have a responsibility related to the health and safety of all Americans to stop amplifying untrustworthy content, disinformation, and misinformation, especially related to COVID-19, vaccinations, and elections. And we've seen that over the past several months, broadly speaking. I'm not placing any blame on any individual or group. We've seen it from a number of sources. He also supports better privacy protections and a robust antitrust program. So his view is that there's more that needs to be done to ensure that this type of misinformation, disinformation, damaging, sometimes life-threatening information is not going out to the American public.
You're saying more that needs to be done. Are there any concerns, though, about First Amendment rights? And where does the White House draw the line on that?
Well, look, I think we are, of course, a believer in First Amendment rights. I think what the decisions are that the social media platforms need to make is how they address the disinformation, misinformation, especially related to life-threatening issues like COVID-19 and vaccinations that continue to proliferate on their platform.
From today's White House briefing with Press Secretary Jen Psaki and questioning from NBC News correspondent Kristen Welker, Facebook's oversight board ruling that the social network was right to bar former President Trump after the insurrection here in Washington on January the 6th, saying that he, quote, created an environment where a serious risk of violence was possible, and the panel said that the ongoing risk justified the move. Kirsten Grine covers social media for The Wall Street Journal. She explained the role of this oversight board.
So the oversight board was set up by Facebook last year because it was under so much pressure for the content decisions that it was making, and it's made up of a group of 20 outside experts. But the way to think about it is basically like a Supreme Court, right? They are not ruling on every single minutia decision that's happening on the platform. So a lot of the focus has been on high-profile figures like President Trump and other figures that have been banned or kicked off of Facebook or Twitter. Well, on the ground floor, there's all these billions of users that every day are posting comments and, you know, trying to deal with all these crazy rules that they don't understand. And the oversight board can't really touch all of that, right? That's not really their role.
Kirsten Grine, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and there is this from The New York Times this evening, quote, The decision adding difficulties to former President Trump rejoining mainstream social media, a key source of his clout that he used during his White House years to directly cajole his tens of millions of followers, exploit their grievances, set policy, and criticize opponents. Twitter and YouTube had also cut off Mr. Trump back in January after the insurrection in the Capitol building, saying the risk and potential for violence that he created were too great. The full story at NYTimes.com. Meanwhile, former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows had this reaction earlier today while appearing on Fox and Friends.
Yeah, it's a sad day for America. It's a sad day for Facebook, because I can tell you a number of members of Congress are now looking at, do they break up Facebook? Do they make sure that they don't have a monopoly? And I can tell you that it is two different standards, one for Donald Trump and one for a number of other people that are on their sites and suggesting that more nefarious things than what the president has been accused of actually go unnoticed often. And so this is a sad day for America, but a sadder day for the Facebooks of the world, who have actually enjoyed a very wild, wild west kind of regulatory environment. I can tell you that's going to change. The discussion will happen within hours of this decision on Capitol Hill, just a few blocks from where I am.
And so let me ask you then about legislation, right? Because you could almost get to bipartisan legislation, but for different reasons, right? Because, for example, Senator Elizabeth Warren wants regulations on big tech. And then you have someone like Senator Hawley, who also feels the same way. They could get to the same place, but for very different reasons. Could they get to the same result? And in this Congress under President Biden?
Well, I would suggest that it's not going to be regulation that they look at from a legislative standpoint. This is going to be a breakup of big tech. You know, when you look at Google and Facebook, they have more power over what we read and what we see than any in the media. Then, you know, we look at very critically at people buying TV stations to say that they shouldn't have a monopoly. And yet Google and Facebook and YouTube actually control much of what America sees, whether it's you and I talking right now and it gets reposted on any of those platforms. They have the ability to actually raise that profile or lower it. And so it is time that we break up big tech, not just regulate them.
That's from former Congressman and former White House Chief of Staff during the Trump administration, Mark Meadows, on Fox News earlier today. And again, the move by Facebook took place after January 6th, the insurrection that resulted in five deaths and the destruction inside the U.S. Capitol. Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn saying Facebook's board's decision was, quote, extremely disappointing, and that it was clear Mark Zuckerberg views himself as the arbiter of free speech. And Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio saying that Facebook, which does face some antitrust scrutiny, as you heard from Mark Meadows, should be broken up. But in a statement, the company, Facebook, saying it was, quote, pleased that the board recognized that barring Donald Trump in January was justified. In other news, Pentagon officials are considering new restrictions on service members and the interactions they have or may be having with fringe groups. The Washington Post is reporting that this effort is part of the military's reckoning with extremism within its own ranks among the armed forces. Missy Ryan covers the Defense Department and national security issues for the Washington Post. We spoke with her earlier today.
Well, the Pentagon, led by Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, has promised that they're going to try to eradicate any support for far-right groups that exist among the ranks. It's a problem that we've known about for decades, and it sort of ebbed and flowed in and out of the news, but it really came to greater scrutiny in the wake of the January 6th Capitol riot, when there was a large number of military veterans in the crowd that stormed the Capitol, and then a handful of current service members. And so that really focused attention on the question, how can this be happening? Why are we seeing this? And so the military then kicked off a process to really, for the first time, try to collect greater information about the extent of this problem in its ranks. It's something that hadn't ever been done before. So they're trying to understand, you know, nobody thinks it's a massive problem, but, you know, they'll say that in terms of the number of people, but they'll say, you know, any extremist is too many. So they're trying to understand what the extent of the problem is. And at the same time, they're trying to look at what the rules should be for current service members. And the way it works right now is that while extremist activities, active participation in extremist groups like a white supremacist group, is currently prohibited under DOD laws or regulations, so-called passive membership is not prohibited. And that means that a service member could be allowed to just be a member if they were not taking part in certain activities or of an extremist group. And that clause really has come under greater scrutiny. And so they're trying to figure out, can we actually extend this to bar passive membership in these groups as well? And that raises the question of troops' First Amendment free speech and right to association.
And that's my follow-up, because how do you balance that, civil rights, personal freedoms, free speech, and the concerns that the Pentagon has over extremism in the military? As you point out in your piece, just how far can the Pentagon go?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think most Americans probably don't know that the First Amendment rights of people in the military are already limited in a way that normal Americans, other Americans, aren't. So they, you know, if they can be punished for, you know, being disrespectful, they can be punished for disparaging the president, for example, and they don't have the same kind of the full extent of First Amendment rights in terms of free speech that most Americans have. But courts have also ruled that they have some First Amendment rights. And so I think the question is, can they take this additional step without facing a barrage of court challenges? And so that's something that right now the lawyers are looking at, and the policy officials at the Pentagon. How far can they go without basically triggering a lengthy court battle?
And you've answered part of that, reminding our listeners we are talking with Missy Ryan of The Washington Post. If you're in the military, can you be penalized for having vocal beliefs?
Yeah, their military members are not allowed to participate in political activities in uniform. They're already prohibited from other activities. But, there is this question that's very that has not been settled, around, online speech in particular, and how that today relates to these very amorphous extremist groups. You can see a scenario where somebody is, in a chat room and making comments, and does that constitute prohibited activity? There's a really lively debate about that right now.
The headline, the Pentagon wants to take a harder line on domestic extremism, the reporting of Missy Ryan, available tonight at WashingtonPost.com. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And now to the House Republican Conference in next week's meeting that is expected to result in the ouster of the number three leader, Representative Liz Cheney. Political.com and others reporting that House Republicans have settled on the member who will introduce the formal resolution removing Liz Cheney from the leadership position. That will come from Representative Virginia Fox. The North Carolina Republican spoke out against Congresswoman Cheney during February's closed-door meeting. Representative Fox specifically took issue with the fact that Liz Cheney used her conference chair title in the press release announcing her vote to impeach then-President Donald Trump. While visiting a Washington, D.C. Mexican restaurant on the Cinco de Mayo, the president commented on the political infighting within the House GOP.
Brother, what'd you get?
Tacos and some enchiladas.
Mr. President, do you have any comments on the efforts to oust Liz Cheney from the House Republican leadership post?
I don't understand your trouble.
That from President Biden, with some cheering in the onlookers outside that D.C. taqueria earlier today. And later at a White House event, President Biden expanding on his comments regarding plans to oust Representative Liz Cheney from the House Republican leadership.
It seems as though the Republican Party is trying to identify what it stands for. And they're in the midst of a significant sort of mini revolution going on in the Republican Party. I've been a Democrat for a long time. We've gone through periods where we've had internal fights and disagreements. I don't ever remember any like this. And so, as one of you said, and I'm not embarrassed by identifying them, as one of you said on national television last night, we badly need a Republican Party. We need a two-party system. It's not healthy to have a one-party system. And I think the Republicans are further away from trying to figure out who they are and what they stand for than I thought they would be at this point.
At the White House earlier today with President Biden, in an editorial published today in the Wall Street Journal, there is this headline, quote, "Purging Liz Cheney. GOP leaders should not have to lie about 2020 to keep their job." The editorial reads in part, quote, "This should be a hopeful moment for House Republicans. While they're playing defense in the minority for now, their prospects for picking up the five net seats they need to regain the majority in 2022 are excellent. That is, unless they devolve into internal brawling over the 2020 election. Yet that is precisely what they seem to be doing as some members try to oust Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney from the GOP House leadership. Ms. Cheney easily surviving an earlier effort to dump her 145-61 after she was one of 10 House Republicans to vote to impeach Donald Trump after the events on January 6th. But she continues to rankle some into the GOP House conference by refusing to go along with Mr. Trump's demand that Republicans agree that the 2020 election was stolen. The full editorial at WSJ.com. However, there does appear to be growing support for her removal from the leadership position. On Fox News earlier today, Republican Congressman Andy Biggs.
What changed is that we actually had the whip count to remove her in February, but Kevin McCarthy said he basically put all his chips in the center of the table, said no, he wanted to try to work with her further, so we lost votes. So she had enough to stay in. What changed more, though, is that she continued her tirade against President Trump and those who support President Trump. And she's doing it from a position as the conference chair. The problem with that is no one cares if she believes that and if she wants to do that if she's not the conference chair. So she wasn't representing the most, and now Kevin's had enough, and that changes it because McCarthy is now with us to remove her, and so there'll be enough votes to remove her next week.
I mean, she's had a very public back and forth with President Trump over this idea of the big lie. President Trump calls the 2020 election the big lie. Liz Cheney says this idea that the election is stolen is the big lie. By ousting her, is the GOP conference endorsing President Trump's view of the 2020 election?
By ousting her, what we're saying is we are repudiating your repudiation of the Trump policies and the Trump agenda and her attacks on the president. So right now, John, if I were to say this, President Trump is the leader of the Republican Party. And when she's out there attacking him, she's attacking the leader of the Republican Party, and she's attacking those of us who supported President Trump. She's attacking the base of the Republican Party who support President Trump. That is really the nub of this issue.
In the Wall Street Journal today, Congressman, the editorial board took the flip side of that coin, writing, quote, Liz Cheney may be ousted because she is daring to tell the truth to GOP voters and at personal political risk. Purging Liz Cheney for honesty would diminish the party. Your response?
I don't even know where they're coming from because I bet that writer doesn't get out and talk to the Republicans that I do on a daily basis, because the Republicans around this country say that the Liz Cheney doesn't represent them. They're still supportive of President Trump. All the polling indicates that President Trump's still the title holder. She can tell what her vision of the truth is, but she can't do it as the leader of the Republican Party in Congress. And that's what she was trying to do.
Arizona Congressman Andy Biggs, Republican, earlier today on Fox News. And joining us on the phone here in Washington is John Bresnahan. He is the co-founder of Punchbowl News and has been following the story intensely over the last few days. Give us a sense of what has happened today, first for Representative Elise Stefanik from upstate New York and for Liz Cheney, the number three right now in the House GOP leadership.
Yeah, so today has been a big day for Representative Stefanik. She has, early in the morning, we reported that the House Minority Whip Steve Scalise was backing Stefanik. And then we also reported that former President Donald Trump was going to back Stefanik, which he has. And throughout the day, she's picked up more members. They've come out publicly and said they're going to support her, including Representative Biggs, So it looks like across the conference, she's getting support. You know, we're being told that Virginia Fox, Congresswoman from North Carolina, will be the one who will offer a motion to replace Congresswoman Cheney as the GOP conference chair. So that's out there. So, like, the pieces are falling in place for Stefanik. Now, as far as Cheney, she's, again, there's a lot of chatter that maybe she steps down from this position, or at least the Republicans are saying to each other. But from everything we hear, that's not going to be the case. Cheney feels very strongly about what Trump did, in the run-up to the election, after the election, in the run-up to January 6th, the insurrection in the Capitol was really destructive for the country, was wrong. She voted for impeachment, and she's kept talking about it, and she's kept pushing this. And, you know, which is the issue here. And she feels that, you know, she can't tell lies, that, you know, the party is still enthralled to Trump, and that it needs to find its way away from Trump, and that this is the crisis. This is the moment when Republicans should be doing it, and they're not.
Let's spend a moment to talk about Congresswoman Elise Stefanik. She is a Harvard grad. She worked on the staff of former President George W. Bush, an aide to Mitt Romney's campaign in 2012, and yet has pivoted to the Trump orbit. How so?
Yeah, things really changed for Stefanik in 2019, the first impeachment of then President Trump. This was over the allegation that he tried to he threatened to cut off aid for Ukraine unless they gave him some information on Biden, on then candidate Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden. And at that point, Stefanik was on the Intelligence Committee, and the first public hearings in those proceedings were in the Intelligence Committee, and she became a very, very vocal defender of Trump. She really grilled witnesses hard. She battled with the Intelligence Committee chairman, Adam Schiff, publicly. They went back and forth during hearings. It was really quite a quite a performance by her, and it caught Trump's eye, and he started a tweet, you know, about her, saying, calling her a rising star. And, you know, back home in her district, those who supported Trump loved what she was doing. She became much more of a national figure. All of a sudden, this moderate, a very bipartisan member up to that point, really became a Trump, outspoken Trump ally. And it, you know, went on and on from there. She became part of his defense team during the Senate trial, where he was acquitted. And then, you know, she got a speaking part at the Republican National Convention. It was a big deal. She talked up her support for Trump, and then she became, you know, this huge polarizing figure nationally. But she was able to use it to help herself get reelected by even better than she had done before. And she raised $11 million last cycle, which is a phenomenal amount of money for a House member. So she really, in 2019, she really made the change from someone who was seen as kind of a bipartisan, low-key member who was focused a lot on, you know, education issues, military issues, she has Fort Drum in her district, to someone who became this really outspoken Trump defender.
And finally, John Bresnahan, you included it this morning in your Punch Bowl News AM morning email, but the Wall Street Journal editorial board urging the Republicans not to, quote, dump Liz Cheney. What was your reaction?
You know, it's an interesting, I mean, and this is all, you know, this is all the continuation of the battle inside the Republican Party for the heart and soul of the party. And this has been going on since Trump emerged as a candidate in June of 2015 and started pushing the party in a much more populist direction. And you have this old-time establishment party, which the Wall Street Journal is a symbol of that, versus, you know, a conservative, you know, small government, traditional values, Republican conservatives, pro-business, versus this populist Republican Party, which Trump remade in his own image. And, you know, the Journal, you know, saying, look, what Cheney is saying is true. This is, you know, look what Trump did following the election and then leading up to January 6th is was terrible for the country, and it was wrong, and Republicans have to call it out. And I think there was a window there after January 6th where I think a lot of Republicans were shocked, even, you know, they became shocked at what happened. But, you know, at this point, Trump is rebuilding his muscle inside the party, and the party's moving back toward Trump. And I think on this one, the Cheney and the Wall Street Journal are on the minority side of this debate.
John Bresnahan, who covers Congress, is the co-founder of Punchbowl News, joining us on the phone here in Washington. Thank you for your time.
Thanks.
And now to the latest on coronavirus. More than 106 million people in the U.S. are fully vaccinated against COVID-19, but data from the CDC showing that the average daily pace of those vaccinations, the pace is beginning to slow. In spite of that, President Biden wanting to see 70% of adult Americans with at least one dose of the vaccine by July 4th. During today's White House briefing, COVID Task Force Director Andy Slavitt was asked about this new White House goal, which is 2 months from now.
Want to know where to get vaccinated? To get your phone, text your zip code to get vax, GETVAX. That's 438-829. That's right. Text your zip code to 438-829, and you'll be texted back three locations near you with vaccines in stock. Easy. Or if you prefer the information in Spanish, text your zip code to vacuna. That's 822-862. Easy. Prefer a specific vaccine? No problem. Click on the text or visit vaccines.gov. You can sort that way. Easy. There are more than 75,000 places you can go to get a shot. In fact, 90% of Americans have a vaccine right now within 5 miles of them. Easy. Prefer not to make an appointment? No problem. At the president's direction, many no-appointment walk-in vaccinations are available. Yesterday, the president directed all our federal pharmacy partners to begin providing walk-in vaccinations wherever supply allows. That means Americans will be able to get vaccinated without an appointment at the majority of our nearly 40,000 local pharmacy locations nationwide. Need a ride? Uber and Lyft are offering free and discounted rides. Live in a remote or rural area without a vaccine near you? We're sending doses directly to rural clinics and expanding mobile vaccination sites and pop-up clinics. And we will announce a call-in number designed for people without broadband or cell phones, where we will help people make appointments and remove other barriers preventing them from getting vaccinated.
That update from Andy Slavitt. He is one of the president's top advisors on COVID-19. Meanwhile, vaccine advisors have also scheduled an emergency meeting slated for May 12th with the Food and Drug Administration to review the Pfizer vaccine, specifically for those between the ages of 12 and 15. It comes as parents wondering about summer camp programs, what's best for their children. Dr. Rochelle Wilinski is the director of the CDC.
I wanted to ask about the summer camp guidance. I was wondering if Dr. Wilinski could respond to some criticism about having kids wear masks outdoors, given that you guys have all talked about the low level of spread outdoor and the low level of transmission among younger children. You know, Dr. Wilinski, could you talk at all about the data or the evidence that the CDC used to make that determination that kids need to be wearing masks outdoors, you know, just in all scenarios, regardless of vaccination status? Is there any middle ground there where kids wouldn't have to wear masks outdoors at camp?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So we have two sets of guidance. We have guidance for masking and if you're vaccinated or unvaccinated outdoors, and we also have this camp guidance. Certainly, if we have authorization for 12 to 15 year olds and they can get vaccinated before going to camp, that's what I would advocate for so that they can take their masks off outdoors. We also have guidance, the camp guidance and the outdoor guidance for individuals who are unvaccinated. So those who are 12 and under who are attending camp. And we have some availability of not wearing your mask outdoors in small groups, in groups with other children who are vaccinated. What we're really trying to avoid in this camp guidance is what we saw in outbreaks and camps last summer. So if you have 5-10-year-olds who are on a soccer field all in front of the same soccer ball, we're trying to make sure that they're not a lot of heavy breathing dancing around a singular soccer ball with five kids around it at the same time. But for spread out activities, our outdoor mask guidance for unvaccinated people, small groups, allows for those kids to be unvaccinated. And what we really are trying to do is ensure that all of these kids can have a really good camp experience and keep the camps open without any outbreaks.
And that update from the CDC director. Meanwhile, a number of states are beginning to ease those restrictions when it comes to this pandemic. For example, Pennsylvania today announcing that effective May 31st, those mitigation orders will be lifted. And the governor's office saying that about half of the state's population has been vaccinated. When it reaches 70%, the mask mandate will also be lifted. And in New York, the lights of Broadway will return this fall. Governor Andrew Cuomo announcing that performances will begin on September 14th. And this note, you can begin purchasing those Broadway tickets starting tomorrow. On Wall Street, the Dow gaining 97 points at the closing bell. The S&P was up nearly 3. The tech-heavy NASDAQ losing ground, dropping 51 points. And a safety recall for a popular exercise treadmill. Peloton admitting that it made a mistake, announcing a voluntary recall today over child safety concerns. The Consumer Product Safety Commission saying that a 6-year-old was killed after being pulled under the rear of the Tread Plus machine. It has been associated with 72 reports of injuries, including 29 children who suffered a range of injuries, including second and third degree abrasions, broken bones, and lacerations. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today for this Wednesday. Here are some of your other headlines. The National Center for Health Statistics reporting that the fertility rate in the U.S. dropped 4% last year when compared to 2019. That is the lowest number in nearly 50 years. And the drug maker Moderna saying a booster shot has generated a promising immune response against new variants of the virus. A virus first identified in South Africa and Brazil, those variants. The new data from ongoing clinical trial as the company looks to see how the vaccine can stop the spread of these variants and the virus itself. Congressman Kevin Brady, the former chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, ranking Republican on that committee, saying President Biden's proposal to raise rates on corporations and rich Americans are, quote, non-starters. The Texas Republican, who, by the way, is retiring at the end of this term after more than two decades in Congress, predicting that there's going to be a real fight over these tax increases and advocated for a different approach on how to pay for the president's infrastructure plan. Well, today, President Biden defending his proposal to tax the wealthiest 1% of Americans, as well as corporations who he says are not paying their fair share. More from the White House.
On the corporate tax rate, have you talked to CEOs about that? And have you?
Yes.
Are you open to, say, 25%?
I'm open to compromising, yes. It doesn't have to be exactly what I say, but to suggest that, which some of the folks are suggesting, and I'm going to meet with Republicans next week when they come back, and seriously meet with them. I'm willing to compromise, but I'm not willing to not pay for what we're talking about. I'm not willing to deficit spend. They already have us $2 trillion in the hole. So, and by the way, you saw, you know, the last five leaders of the Fed coming out and saying, what'd they say? They said Biden's plan is going to grow the economy. You have Moody's talking about increasing up to, I don't know what the most recent one is, 16 million new jobs. It's about growth, not stunting growth. Like I said, not too long ago, I guess it was back in the 2000 range thereabout. Don't hold me the exact year. I'll have my staff come back with the exact date. The average CEO of the Fortune 500 companies made like 36 times what the average employee of that corporation made. It's over 450 times as much now. As my mother would say, who died and left them boss? No, seriously, what rationale? Tell me what benefit flows from that. We're not going to deprive any of these executives of their second or third home. Travel privately by jet, that's not going to affect their standard of living at all. Not a little tiny bit. But I can affect the standard of living of the people I grew up with. If they have a job, I can expect to make sure the standard of living of people I grew up with, if they have child care, can afford it, so 20 million women can be back in the workforce. This is just not, makes no sense to me. But I'm going to have to be able to explain this, and I'm going to keep banging at it. I think I'm not being solicitous, and I'm not trying to ruin your reputation. I think most of you understand what I'm saying. Whether you agree with me or not, I think you understand what I'm saying. And it's fair to say this is about making the average multimillionaire pay just a fair share. It's not going to affect their standard of living a little bit.
The president taking questions earlier today in the White House. In other news here in Washington, the acting head of the Transportation Security Administration telling a House committee that even with reduced traffic during the coronavirus pandemic, more people attempted to pass firearms through airport checkpoints in 2020 than the year before. Darby LaJoy is a senior TSA official who is the acting administrator, telling members of a House Appropriations Subcommittee that the number of firearms per million passengers detected at checkpoints last year was double the level recorded in 2019, adding that most of those weapons were fully loaded. In the last week of April of 2020 alone, TSA agents stopped 120 guns from making it aboard aircrafts. And in just one day, nationwide, there were 32 firearms found on passengers going through those checkpoints. Now, the subcommittee's chair, Representative Lucille Roybal-Allard, pointing out the staffing challenges for TSA in light of this pandemic. Here is how that line of questioning unfolded earlier today.
You talked a little bit about this in your opening statement about the steps that were taken to protect your workforce and the traveling public from COVID-19. How will those efforts change over the coming months as both the number of passengers and vaccination levels increase? Well, at the same time, we know not every passenger will have been vaccinated.
Well, again, Madam Chair, you know, one of the things from the very beginning, we followed the science and we listened to our chief medical officer. We put in place, you know, the measures that were advised from the CDC and from our chief medical officer are the things we put in place to help protect the workforce. So very, very early on, even before we had dedicated sort of PPE supply lines, we made it voluntary for our employees to wear surgical masks. And once we did have dedicated supplies coming in of surgical masks, it became a requirement for TSA officers to wear surgical masks. Following soon, it became a requirement that they wear eye protection to include face shields if they weren't standing behind the plexiglass shielding that you see in so many airports today. That remains the requirement today. I'm also happy to report that as I'm sitting here, 60% of TSA employees have received their first shot, and a full 40% have been fully vaccinated. The priority under the department is placed on vaccinating our workforce. It really has been a game changer from where we were several months ago. So we continue to emphasize the importance to our workforce and going and getting the vaccine. And I'm very confident that at this point, any TSA employee who desires to go get the vaccine has the ability to do so.
That from Darby LaJoy. He is the acting TSA administrator. By the way, the agency does expect to hire another 1,600 workers to fully staff airports nationwide as air travel begins to increase. More from the hearing. Here's Republican Congressman Chuck Fleischmann of Tennessee.
Last week, it was announced that TSA is extending the mask requirements for travelers across all transportation networks through Monday, September the 13th. Mr. LaJoy, can you explain the factors that went into deciding on this extension and why this date was chosen? And as a follow-up question, sir, what challenges have been encountered in the enforcement of this mandate and what actions has TSA taken as a result, sir?
Well, thank you, sir, for the question. So from, you know, since January in this past year, in keeping with, you know, President Biden's executive order for the whole of government to focus on protecting the traveling public, we did mandate the requirement for surgical masks in all modes of transportation. And as we've been approaching that deadline, we work very, very closely with CDC because, you know, the recommendation still remains that to best protect the traveling public, the use and the requirement for surgical masks continues to be that which is recommended from CDC. And so that's the decision that went into extending the mandate. Some of the challenges we've had, you know, to date we've had about 2,000 total incidents involving non-compliance of a mask. About 90% of that's happening on board the aircraft. I can tell you that, you know, we've most of these that we are pursuing enforcement actions in the form of a warning order. You know, we remind passengers, place the mask on, but where we have wanton, egregious violations of that, there have been arrests that have been made, and we have enforced civil penalties for especially egregious cases. So that continues to remain a challenge for us. We have had outstanding partnership across aviation, surface, and airport partners in helping to enforce this mandate. We work very, very closely with the FAA as well as the CDC in making sure that, you know, as we continue, that we're keeping up with any, you know, updated guidance from the CDC. And again, the message for the traveling public is, you know, please adhere to the mask requirements, because it can result in a civil penalty, or in really egregious cases where it results in an assault on a flight crew, criminal penalties to include an arrest.
That update from Darby LaJoy, again, the acting TSA administrator before a House subcommittee. And at the Pentagon today, spokesperson John Kirby explaining the movement of military forces across Europe, 28,000 troops from a total of 26 countries being positioned near the Russian border, with a special emphasis on the Balkans and the Black Sea region. We'll get some background in just a minute from the Washington Examiner's Pentagon correspondent, but first this from today's briefing.
Defender Europe 21, given the scope of the exercises and the 26 countries involved, why is it that folks on the other side of the exercises wouldn't perceive this as aggression, not defensive? I know you've spoken to this before, but it just seems to be one of those things that kind of hangs there. And then I have a follow-up.
It's an exercise we do annually. It's an exercise we do very transparently, and it is a defensive exercise. You can actually look at what we're doing, and we explain what we're doing. We put it in full view so that people can see the kinds of capabilities that we're trying to improve. It's self-evident if you take a look at what's happening inside that exercise. And again, I would remind, it's an annual exercise. This is not something that just popped onto the schedule in response to recent events. It is an annual exercise.
From today's Pentagon briefing, Abraham Ashy was there. He covers the Defense Department for the Washington Examiner. And let me begin with what is going on. What's the intent of the Defense Department in Europe?
Thanks for having me, Steve. Well, this is an annual exercise done every year. Last year's was scaled back significantly because of COVID, but there were still some operations that took place out there. Basically, it's an interoperability and integration of the Army practicing retrieving pre-positioned materials and working with our NATO partners and allies in Europe. And what's happening that's different this year is it's really focusing on the Black Sea and Balkans region, which are countries that haven't really practiced so much interoperability with the United States. And so we're really enhancing its relationships in that southeast corner of NATO.
And we saw similar exercises by the Russian military earlier this year, correct?
So I think that the way that the Pentagon is explaining that as a transparency issue and not at all similar, Russia amassed up to about 100,000 troops on the Ukrainian border, on the eastern Ukraine border, and they didn't advise ahead of time. There was no clear description of what was going on there, and still there's a sizable number of troops on that border in occupied Crimea, whereas this exercise is planned every year. It's open. Like you just heard John Kirby talking about, it is open for people to see it. Everyone in the organization of Security Cooperation in Europe is informed, and that includes Russia, is informed that these exercises are happening. There are observers.
And as you point out in your piece available at WashingtonExaminer.com, that this will be over the next 6 weeks with a goal to do what? What is the military's objective?
I think the idea here is practice with partners so that the U.S. can quickly move troops and equipment over vast distances in the event of a crisis. So military leaders, like there was a call this morning from Estonia about some exercises that are just kicking off there. of course, in the Baltic area, which is right on the Russian border as well. The idea is show the partnership, enhance deterrence towards Russia, show the strength of the alliance, interoperability. And so even though the Pentagon and the commanders in the field won't say Russia per se, they don't like to use the word Russia, that is the deterrent for, it's for threats against Russia. It's to demonstrate the U.S. commitment to the NATO alliance, and it's done principally on the eastern flank, which is, you know, up in the Baltics, down in the southeast area and Black Sea and Balkans area, which is very close to heavily militarized Crimea.
And having sat through today's Defense Department briefing with John Kirby, what questions in your mind have gone unanswered?
So I asked the question this, not to Kirby today, but this morning I asked some commanders who are involved in the operations that just kicked off in Europe. I asked them about the level of military infrastructure and roads and ports and airports that are in that southeast corner of Europe. These are former Yugoslav states. These are some of the less wealthy countries of the European Union, but they are countries that spend the most by percentage on defense, and they are very eager to strengthen their relationships with the United States. They buy a lot of U.S. Military equipment. They invite rotational forces. They want to work more closely with the United States. They want to have a stronger partnership. They want to increase that deterrence value. So what I believe that is not being clearly answered, or perhaps this is because this is the reason why they're doing this, right, is to test what are the capabilities of those countries right now. And I think that what you're going to have is Defender Europe is going to find out what's missing and where more investment is needed from NATO or through the European Deterrence Initiative.
Abraham Ashy covers the Defense Department for the Washington Examiner. He's joining us from the Pentagon. His work available at WashingtonExaminer.com. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
And finally, a milestone. 60 years ago today, Alan Shepard became the first American in space, a 15-minute flight on May 5th, 1961. That mission in part prompting President Kennedy's goal to safely put a man on the moon by the end of the 1960s. And during a speech at Drew University in 1994, Alan Shepard reflecting on that moment.
I did fly about 3 weeks after Gagarin flew and did exactly what I was supposed to do. Didn't make any mistakes, fortunately. Came back and a huge welcome, because I was invited back to get a medal from President Kennedy. And just the whole country seemed all of a sudden to say, yeah, you know, maybe we're in this space race after all. And I think Kennedy sensed that, because the plan originally was for me to get the medal, which, by the way, he dropped. It's kind of cute. He said some nice things about me. He was about to get the medal, and Jim Webb, who was the administrator of NASA at the time, leaned forward, and the medal was in a box, but it wasn't pinned in there, so it slipped to the ground. And I almost bumped heads with the President of the United States. Both of us went down to try to pick this thing up, and he said, here. And he stuck it out like that. And Jackie is in the back, and she's saying, Jack, pin it on. So he recovered then, and he pinned it on. He said, I present you this medal, which comes from the ground up.
That from Alan Shepard back in 1994. You can find that in the C-SPAN video library at cspan.org. This note, Alan Shepard did die 4 years after that speech. He had been battling cancer. He was a Naval Academy graduate. He also commanded the Apollo 14 mission in 1971. And this side note, became the first astronaut to golf on the moon, but it was 60 years ago today. He became the first American in space. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available wherever you get your podcasts, so be sure to listen and follow and check out all of our coverage online anytime at cspan.org. I'm Steve Scully for the Wednesday edition of Washington Today, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.